hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Well, this is an important show today. There is no more urgent and pressing issue right now in America for our most vulnerable young Americans, and that is babies in the womb and pregnant women considering the COVID-19 vaccine. I had a chance to review this with Tucker Carlson on Tucker Carlson Today in May of 2021. Let's listen.
Interesting that people who work at a hospital wouldn't want the vaccine. I mean, these aren't people who work at a Goodyear plant. I mean, these are people who work around medicine. I mean, that's what they do for a living. They're around medicine. They're also around COVID. They have a much higher chance of getting infected with it if you work in a hospital.
Well, listen,
But they still don't want it.
No, but they know the clinical trials. This is very important because we participate in the clinical trials. The FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, strictly excluded, COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, those with antibodies, pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who couldn't assure contraception. That is a huge group of exclusions. That's a giant part of the healthcare workforce. So of course they looked at that.
That's a giant chunk of America.
So Tucker, if they weren't eligible for the randomized trials and said, you know what, the FDA and the sponsors thought maybe there was a problem with safety, or they had no chance of benefit and only a small chance of these safety events, exclude them, why would they electively go into an investigational program now?
So I don't think most Americans are even aware of that. I mean, the fact that pregnant women were excluded from the safety trials, I think, is fairly widely known. I think it's less known that COVID recovered, and that, I don't know how many tens of millions of Americans fall into that category, but certainly tens of millions have had COVID, whether they knew it or not, and recovered from it. They were excluded from the trials. Why? On what grounds?
Well, very good grounds. COVID-recovered patients so far are racking up a terrific track record of freedom from reinfection. It's nearly airtight. Think about it. SARS-CoV-1 is 80% homologous to SARS-CoV-1 and 2 are 80% the same. The first SARS pandemic, people had durable and complete immunity, 17 years so far. You don't get it twice. We've had 111 million people in the world who've gotten this infection. If there was a chance for double and triple infections in the same person, we would have seen it by the millions, millions. If you look in the literature, maybe you can find 100 cases where someone says, you know, I think they got reinfected. And we look, and almost always it's a misinterpretation of one of these PCR tests, which is commonly false positive.
Yes.
And then someone sick over here, the most recent one from France, it was obviously a misinterpretation. One of the false narratives out there is you can get the infection twice. It's a false narrative. And the FDA...
Why would people say that?
Well, listen, the FDA and the sponsors knew that. Of course they excluded COVID-recovered patients. They know you can't get it again. They're not going to have them in a clinical trial and have the clinical trial go to the null. They knew that. But when it came out, I think in an air of caution, this would be the innocent explanation, air of caution, they said, you know what, we'll make it available to everybody. But quickly making it available to everybody started to become a coercive thing. So now people are saying, listen, I'm COVID recovered, I'm pregnant, I was never even tested in the study, is this safe? Remember, in pregnant women, the only thing we allow is the inactivated flu shot and the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, which is inactive. We never let anything pathogenic into a woman's body who's pregnant, never. When we give the vaccine, all the forms of the vaccine produce the viral spike protein. They produce one type, by the way, the Wuhan original type, which, by the way, it's long gone in the United States. We got 14 strains right now. Wuhan original is not one of them. But you produce that in a high quantity in the body. That is directly pathogenic. It causes blood clotting. It damages the blood vessels, causes fever. So we are actually having women's bodies produce a pathogenic protein for a few days.
And we don't do that with any other vaccine.
Never.
I'm trying not to use the F word on TV now, but I'm getting upset hearing this. Why would we do that?
I'm not a public health official. I'm a doctor. I don't think like public health officials. It, appears to be out of an air of we've had a year of this difficult time in America of trying to make a new product through American innovation available to everybody. And there was an idea of, we'll make it available and then try to weigh benefit and risk later on under the investigational EUA period. As a doctor, I can tell you, I am not recommending pregnant women get the vaccine. I'm not recommending actually any of the excluded groups from the trials get the vaccine. We have no information on safety and we have no information on efficacy. It violates a simple medical practice principle. We don't use things where we don't have a signal of benefit or acceptable safety. We don't do it.
And yet you're one of the very few physicians, particularly, I would say, eminent physicians, who's willing to say this in public.
Well, I can tell you, I've brought some more eminent physicians on today's show. I have Dr. Stephen Malthouse from British Columbia, who's been very outspoken on his overall assessment of the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine, followed by Dr. Raphael Stricker, who's considered one of the nation's leading experts on fetal loss with respect to women who get various infections or have medical problems. Then lastly, Dr. Lila Gilbert, who is a practicing obstetrician, and she's actively advising her patients who are pregnant concerning the COVID-19 vaccine. So why don't you sit back, get those ear pods in, or better yet, get your running shoes on and out in and around the neighborhood, in the park, and listen to this important issue of the McCullough Report. I know in your circle that you have women who are of childbearing potential or who are potentially considering pregnancy or who are pregnant and are contemplating the COVID-19 vaccine. So there couldn't be any more pressing discussion and fair review of this topic concerning them and the health of their pregnancy. Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report, and this is Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to invite on the show Dr. Stephen Malthouse. Dr. Malthouse did his combined undergraduate and medical degree at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, and then served his general internship in Victoria, British Columbia, at the Victoria General Hospital. He is a senior practitioner in practice with his wife, who practices naturopathic medicine on the beautiful Denman Island in the province of British Columbia. Now, if you look at Vancouver Island, it's one of the longest islands you'll ever see on the map. And Denman Island is one of those little dots along the eastern coast of Denman Island. And I know about it because I did my residency at University of Washington in Seattle about the time Dr. Malthouse settled there on Denman Island. Dr. Malthouse, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thanks, Peter. It's nice to be here.
Well, I was impressed by the really rapid developing pace of the U.S. and Canadian and worldwide mass vaccination program, and it has raised a lot of questions for all of us. And I wanted your viewpoints on this since the vaccines went through the clinical trials so quickly. Can you explain to the audience what the clinical trial program was, and then how are things generalizing to the population choosing to get vaccination at this time?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, there are four of these what we call vaccines, although they're not really vaccines because they don't prevent or have not been shown to prevent transmission or the fact that you can still catch it even if you've had the shot. But, you know, they were, a lot of them skipped or did very cursory animal studies before rolling into the human studies. And the human studies were only 2 months long in the Pfizer case. So that's really not long enough. Most vaccines or most drugs take 5 to 10 years, you know, of looking at them very carefully, looking for side effects and even looking to see if they're beneficial at all. And so, you know, everything was truncated very short. People should be really having some red flags go up thinking, what, why would they push that so fast and then have such a coercive system in trying to get people to get those shots, even to the point where they're offering them free donuts and $5 to have a beer. You kind of wonder about that, don't you?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, donuts would be probably the mildest form of coercion. You know, it's obviously much more severe than that. We in Houston yesterday, someone was fired because they elected not to take the vaccine. And in Europe, people are being told they can't travel, vaccine passports, in Israel. The kids at any age can't return to school. So it's we're way beyond donuts at this point.
Oh, yeah, we certainly are. And people have to really start to wonder, and I hope they are wondering and waking up to what is really going on behind this shot program, because you know, the studies were very short, but what they did not show whether these shots really have benefit for anyone. If we look at absolute risk reduction, it's less than 1%. It's not that 95%, which is a relative risk reduction. It's kind of a way of spinning the numbers and coming out with something which sounds great and gets past the emergency use authorization board. But in fact, these vaccines are what, again, not vaccines. They're not something that I would recommend to any patients. And certainly there were so many age groups that were not tested fairly in these very short studies that we can't really get informed consent or get from our patients because we can't inform them properly of the risks and benefits. So yeah, there's a lot more behind this than just getting a shot in the arm.
Well, what were the groups that really weren't tested at all in the clinical trials program?
Well, one of the most, I think, atrocious things is recommending vaccines to these shots to pregnant women. They weren't tested in the trials at all. And also the elderly, we had very few people over the age of 65 in these trials. And the other thing is they didn't measure hospitalizations, ICU admissions, or deaths. They didn't measure transmission. These are the most important things you would normally have in a trial. But, you know, going after pregnant women and their babies, that is really, that's unethical as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, saying that, you know, the patients can go and discuss it with their doctor. And if the doctor thinks it's more risky to get COVID than it is to have the shot, then they should say, go ahead. I mean, that's really lunacy because, you know, most doctors up here north of the border, they have no idea what's in these shots and what the adverse effects, and they don't even know what the trials were. So it's a bit like the blind. I wouldn't say leading the blind. I think sometimes the public knows more than the doctors do. But it's certainly, you know, a decision made among a GP and a pregnant woman. They don't have the tools to make that decision.
Well, let me read you the data. They were just released today up through April 23rd, 2021. Now, they're U.S. data. I'm sure that must be similar to Canadian systems. But at roughly 100 million Americans fully vaccinated, we have 3,544 deaths, and we have over 40,000 hospitalization, urgent care, and office visits related to the vaccine, 636 recorded cases of anaphylaxis. How does this stack up compared to other vaccines? These numbers seem big.
Oh, they're huge. They're huge. So you mean over 3,500 deaths, about that, in the United States. And if we look at the Harvard study that showed that less than 1% of vaccine adverse events injuries were actually reported to the VAERS system, which is a completely passive system down south of the border. You know, you'd have to say, hey, could we potentially have more than 300,000 deaths from these shots that just most of them have not been reported? And that is quite possible. You know, recent study out of observational study out of Massachusetts Hospital showed that even though anaphylaxis, which is that, you know, sudden attack that people get when they get a shot where they pass faint or, you know, have swelling, difficulty breathing, et cetera. That even though that is a compulsorily, it has to be reported to the VAERS system. It's compulsory, that less than 1% were actually reported. So I think it's the same as that Harvard study showed many years ago, is that less than 1% of adverse events are being reported. And if we look at actually the rate of reporting, we see there's a, seems to be that the NHS is, whoever it is down south, is holding back the information from the VAERS reports as well, because there's some peculiar things when you look at the graph of the reports that there's a big gap in the center. Like, wait a minute, how we don't have a lot of reports in this period? So, yeah, I think that's the tip of the iceberg there, Peter. That 3,400.
Well, if we add the U.S. and the European adverse event reporting system, we're at 10,000 deaths. And if this is right, and let's say it's 10 times or 100-fold more, that would mean that almost everybody listening knows somebody who had either died or been seriously injured with the vaccine. And I think that's the case now. As I talk to individuals, I talk to my patients, relatives, almost everybody knows somebody who's been hurt with the vaccine.
Yep. Even on our little island, we may have had two people who are dead after that, after the shot. Now, it's pretty hard, you know, time-wise to show it, because sometimes they'll have symptoms come on 24 hours later, and then they don't die for, you know, a week or so, or they kind of linger and they die, you know, 2 weeks away. And then people say, well, that's just coincidental. But if you trace it back, you often find that they started feeling unwell shortly after the shots. And I can't remember what the percentage is, maybe 30% of people die within, or have symptoms of an adverse reaction within 48 hours. So that's, it's a lot of people having stuff. And, you know, if you're really sick, it's a bit like the influenza, you know, they don't come into the family doctor's office because they're too sick. They're in bed. They don't come until they tell you afterwards, hey, I had the flu in January and I was really, really sick. And I think we may be finding a lot of people are, you know, are having adverse events, but they're not reporting because they can't get out of bed.
Well, I initially had recommended it to my patients broadly. And as I've been watching the safety data come in, of which we're supposed to, I mean, the CDC is not a treating doctor and the FDA isn't. And all through their guidance, they say, consult your doctor. I was recommending it broadly when asked, and it's become more and more narrow. And I'm at the point now where I think it's very difficult for a doctor to look at these numbers and navigate a favorable benefit to risk ratio. And the challenge is everything's below 1%. You know, the chances of getting the virus are below 1%. If you get the vaccine or the placebo, less than 1%. All these safety events are less than 1%. The one thing that's different, though, is that when you get COVID, that's kind of a naturally occurring illness, which, you know, there are treatments for. We won't go into it today, but it is treatable. We can prevent hospitalization and death. When you elect to get the vaccine, once it's done, you can't get it out of your body. It's a committed step, and you elect to do it when you're well.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me. And there's nobody that I would recommend this shot to. I agree with you, Peter. There are lots of preventive measures from, you know, multi-dose, multi-medicine approaches like you've recommended, which include things like ivermectin and inhaled steroids. And we also have, you know, ozone, and we have nebulized hydrogen peroxide, homeopathy, TCM, high-dose vitamin C, high-dose vitamin D. All those things have been shown to be beneficial. But, you know, they were really downplayed and, in fact, blocked. Certainly have been up here in Canada. So that we could roll those shots out. And again, this should make people wonder, why aren't our public health officials recommending vitamin D? The evidence is in. It reduces hospitalizations, and also for the regard to COVID, it reduces deaths and severity in terms of ICU admission. So you've got to think something is really, really fishy here. And personally, I think there's another agenda behind these shots, which has got nothing to do with the virus.
Well, they've clearly been weaponized. I mean, we've seen very rapidly from an investigational vaccine to being required for passports, being required for children to attend school, people losing their jobs over not electing to have an investigational vaccine. And we've seen a complete running roughshod over what's called the Nuremberg Code and the principle of autonomy. So what's your understanding of that?
Well, the Nuremberg Code was to do with human trials. And in fact, we're in phase three of the trials for these drugs, right? They haven't been fully trialed. So to have to be in a trial, an experiment as a human, two things have to be there. One, you have to provide informed consent and be capable of providing that, which means that you have enough information to be informed. And we don't have that for these shots. And the other one is they have to be preceded by adequate animal trials. And that was not done either. So in fact, this is going against the Nuremberg Code, which means that in human experimentation, we have certain requirements. And in fact, I think a lot of people are going to end up at Nuremberg Trial 2.0 after this.
It certainly is unprecedented. I know a lot of legal firms are kind of sharpening their approach now, and already there have been declarations of what's called crimes against humanity on twofold. One is the adverse effects of lockdowns that never had scientific support, and masking, and all the weaponization of what we call contagion control. And now the same with the vaccine, taking the vaccine from an elective voluntary offering from the government and then making it become this this menace, if you will, to society. And I have patients and who are absolutely terrified of having their children now undergo forced vaccination. And currently the vaccine centers in my town, they're empty. The parking lot is empty. I think the message has gotten out to the public that there's a problem with these vaccines. And you know, I have had family members that are vaccinated. I'm not anti-vax. I've been fully vaccinated with all the safe and effective vaccines that I have been required to my entire life. My kids are. I'm not anti-vax, but there's something about this one that yeah. seems to be on a different plane. You know, we didn't talk about the pneumococcal vaccine like this, or the shingles vaccine, or the, you know, there's something about this one, which is absolutely wild. It comes up every day. In fact, you sit down in the coffee room at the hospital, the only thing people want to know is, did you take the vaccine?
Yeah. If you sit down in one of those coffee rooms, you find that a number of the people in the room probably have coffee dripping out the side of their mouths from their Bell's palsy that they're not allowed to report because of the hospital's oversight on them and threats of losing their jobs. But these facial paralysis and other neurological diseases that people are getting right, left and center here are you know, coming from those shots. And yeah, this is a different kettle of fish. And this is why, and again, the speed with which everyone is trying to push this on us, get us to get that shot, you know, almost before you can think, it must make you kind of wonder what is really going on here.
Well, the most innocent explanation is that we've had 14 months of continuous fear, isolation, and lockdown, and we're just not thinking straight, that we're taking something that's investigational and voluntary and now writing it into mandatory way of life to even travel, work, go to school. Etc. So the innocent explanation is that it's all driven by fear and disoriented thinking. The more nefarious thinking is that, wait a minute, this whole thing was planned out in a way that this is being capitalized on, or maybe the first part of the plan was to unleash a virus on the world. The second part of the plan is now to get a needle in every arm. Even the militaristic terms that are being used, you know, trucks are rolling out and showing films of well-muscled men horsing around pallets of frozen Pfizer vaccines and then needles in every arm. In my city right now, you'll see a muscled arm and this mantra of getting a needle in every arm. And I have to tell you, I think the U.S. public has really lost their appetite for a needle in every arm. The enthusiasm is dropping. Now there's a lot of efforts on rounding up people. My hospital has announced a census program, that they are going to create a census of those who've accepted the vaccine and those who haven't, and those who haven't, that they're going to undergo special approaches and counseling and being discussed at leadership meetings. And this yeah. is very akin to the Third Reich here, that we're going to create a census of people and exactly. treat them differently and mark yeah. them. That yeah. the vaccine is almost a special mark.
I think you're right there, Peter. And I mean, we know that things are coming down the pike, which are, you know, tattoos, invisible to the eye, but you can read them with a cell phone. And also, you know, nanotechnology has advanced so far that the possibility that we actually have nanotechnology in these shots is not a stretch of the imagination by any means. I agree with you. There's something very odd going on here, and the militaristic, and, you know, in Canada, essentially we're moving towards, you know, military rule here. And, you know, the police are stopping people on the highway. If you ever see any things, any clips of what's going on in Montreal, you see the police are actually targeting the Jewish population at night for, you know, after curfews and so forth, even though they have travel papers. I mean, travel papers. When do we ever think we need that to go out at nighttime in Canada, right? It's not like anything's happening here. And if you look around, well, if you put your ear to look outside your door or listen, you don't hear any ambulances going by. This is not to do with the virus. I think that the virus is created for the vaccine, not the other way around. And then we have to think, okay, well, why would you want to get a vaccine into so many people so fast before they have a chance to think it through or talk to each other because they're behind masks and isolated in their homes? Yeah, there's something nefarious going on here. You're right about that.
Right. Or even, you know, having a careful safety review and risk mitigation
Something is going on. I think historians, when they dig through this, one of the things on the Center for Disease Control website, that's, you know, kind of our central organization giving voluntary recommendations, public health recommendations, they have mention after mention on the CDC webpage that there is no nanotechnology in the vaccines. There's no tracking devices in the vaccines. Well, why would they go to so much effort to say that it's not in there?
Well, why do you think, Peter?
It is interesting. I do have to tell you, though, there are data suggesting the virus itself marks people. And there's a U.S. FDA clear test called T-cell direct test. It actually tests for minor chromosomal rearrangements in T-cells using next-generation sequencing, because the virus itself actually changes the chromosomes in the body slightly. And that is what causes, to some degree, your cellular and innate immunity, because you express different cell surface receptors. But mm-hmm. the virus does permanently mark people, and the T-cell direct test is prima facie evidence that that's the case. And I would not be surprised if the vaccine really is a form of marking in some way.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I think so too, Peter. And, you know, viruses have been, through reverse transcriptase, have been having effects on our DNA for a long time. And I mean, I don't know how much percent of our DNA is actually viral DNA, but a significant amount. And I just wonder, you know, I don't think that these shots are designed, again, to protect us from a virus, because they didn't really even want to bother to show that in the trials. But I think they are introducing things into our system which are going to have effects on our genetic makeup. I think that's actually part of the goal. And they certainly have the technology for it. So you send something that goes into the cell that also has nanotechnology and potentially something called hydrogel in it, which is nanotechnology, then, you know, there's a lot that can be done. And I think most of us are in the dark about it, except we feel like it's a takeover by our government and by our, you know, military and our, you know, forces that are a little bit higher up the food chain than us, of the general population. So yeah, actually we're in trouble here. We can't wait for the historians. We need to wake up right now.
We need to wake up. And I can tell you, if any part of this plan is dependent on the booster, I think the perpetrators are in trouble, because I can tell you, patient after patient in my office said, "Doctor, listen, I went through the two shots, but there's no way I'm doing the booster." There's no way. They just have had their fill. I think you're right. I think it's 80 to 90% of people really have bad reactions, and their appetite for this is about zero. So I'll be interested to see what types of fear, coercion, other tactics are going to round people up for the booster, because we're about halfway through Americans right now. And I think we're just exhausted. The people are just saying, listen, we're done. We're just not going to do it. So we'll have to see. Dr. Malthus, any final words for our audience?
Well, I think the key here is that we've trusted our experts for such a long time, and they have guided us down the wrong path here, particularly in public health in Canada. And there's no mitigation policy that they've rolled out anywhere in Canada that has not done harm to the populace. They've done nothing that has done good. And I think this is a lesson for us. Two things. One is we have to stop trusting our experts. We have to do the research ourselves. I think this is very evident now. And the other one is, when we see that we're being lied to, or that there's some false narrative going on here, and we're told to do things which are absurd or even harmful, particularly to our children, like masking them, I think people have to, you know, develop, I guess, reach inside and bring up their integrity to a level where they'll actually stand up and speak out. And when it comes to the shot, I agree with you, and I think agree with most Americans and Canadians who've had two of them, is you're going to have to draw a line in that sand and say, I'm not going to have that anymore. That's it, no matter what you do to me. So I think integrity, this is kind of a big integrity test, I think, in the long run, people having to stand up and decide what it is to be a real human.
Yeah, I think the vaccine actually is the line. And I think people will draw it at different levels. They may say, listen, never. Or they're going to say, well, I'll take one and I just can't take any more. But I think the vaccine is the line. It's a symbolic line, too. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Dr. Malthus, thank you so much for joining me on the McCullough Report.
Thanks, Peter.
Because of COVID-19, The average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. And this is Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show today, Dr. Raphael Stricker. Ray Stricker received his bachelor's degree from Columbia University, went on to stay at Columbia School of Medicine in New York City, and then his residency there as well. He went on to do infectious disease fellowship at the University of California in San Francisco, considered to be widely considered to be the top training program in the United States. And the San Francisco Bay Area is very fortunate to have Dr. Stricker stay there in a dedicated infectious disease practice. But also one of his duties, very importantly today for this topic, is that he is medical director for a clinic that focuses on pregnancy loss or fetal loss for women and its relationship to various diseases and a lot of infectious diseases. So we want his opinions today regarding the issue of COVID-19 vaccine in pregnant women. Dr. Stricker, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here. The issue of vaccine safety in pregnancy is really a very big one. And we recently saw an article from the New England Journal of Medicine claiming that this was a relatively safe treatment for pregnant women. I think that that article is based on a lot of conjecture and facts that we don't really have at this point. And that's something that people need to be aware of.
You know, the original guidance from the US FDA on vaccine safety indicated we needed a minimum of 24 months to understand the immediate safety implications of a vaccine. And with Operation Warp Speed, that was all condensed to 2 months period of time. And for Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, and the US FDA worked together, but they actively excluded pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who could not assure contraception. And now with the emergency use authorization, the CDC and FDA has made this available to pregnant women as well as women who are childbearing potential. But the doctor isn't involved. As everyone understands, it's a voluntary program. And so women are looking to guidance from doctors and in experts on this. Dr. Stricker, what are the issues with this specific vaccine and what happens inside a woman's body?
So this vaccine, particularly the RNA vaccines, produce a protein that's part of the coronavirus protein armamentarium. And this protein gets produced by a lot of different cells in a lot of different places. We don't really know what this protein does. It can do good things, it could do bad things. And I think giving an experimental vaccine like this, we don't have the information to say that it's safe. We just don't have years of experience like we would have with other vaccines to say that this is a safe process. I think that's particularly true of pregnant women, where you don't want to give something that's going to harm both the woman and her baby. And that may be what we're doing in this case. We just don't know.
Well, the spike protein, which is produced, it's transcribed from these messenger RNA vaccines, not transcribed, but actually the protein is produced. And if it's the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it's a DNA adenoviral vector. But again, the gene is inserted temporarily in human cells that produces the messenger RNA that codes for the spike protein. The point I want the audience to understand is this circulating protein causes damage to blood vessels, as shown in animal studies, and is thought to really account for the fever, the nausea, vomiting, a lot of the symptoms that happen in COVID-19. And because the placenta is quite a vascular organ, there's a great concern that the spike protein itself, unlike inactivated vaccines, which just produce an immune response against a foreign protein, this one is actually the first time ever in the history of medicine that we have a circulating dangerous protein produced. We know this is happening. That's the mechanism of how the vaccine works, happening in a woman's body. So Dr. Stricker, what do we know from the most recent CDC vaccine adverse event reporting system data on women who actually have elected to take the vaccine?
Well, it does look like there is an increased risk in women who get this vaccine during pregnancy, especially for late miscarriage. That's been an issue with the vaccine. And again, we only have very sketchy information about this. We don't really know what the risks are. Certainly giving a vaccine that does what you just said to a person who's in a hypercoagulable state, so pregnancy really is a hypercoagulable state, is a risk for these women, that they could have problems with blood clotting, problems with inflammation, and that's something that we just don't know at this point.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize, I'm sure some of our listeners are women who in fact had a blood clot in their leg, a deep venous thrombosis, or even a blood clot shooting to the lungs, a pulmonary embolism. Those can be very scary events. And the concern is that the vaccine could cause such an event in a woman and actually hurt the woman herself. And then the vaccine be related to late miscarriages. We'll have to see, but my understanding of the data is that because the program is only 4 months long and pregnancy takes 9 months, that snapshot of information that we had from the CDC can only be a slice in time. And since the overall rate of fetal loss was 13.9% in women who could have been tracked to the end of a pregnancy, whether it happened full term or because of a early termination of a pregnancy that happened naturally, that 13.9% number can only grow in size. And the great concern is that if pregnancy vaccine centers are open and large numbers of women undergo vaccination, we could start to see shockingly high numbers. The CDC data predicted.
That's exactly right, Peter. And again, we don't know what the risk is because we haven't had enough time to evaluate these vaccines. There is some evidence that the late miscarriage rate with these vaccines is higher, much higher than normal. Some people have said something like 8 times higher, but we really don't know at this point. We need much more data. We need more time to evaluate these vaccines in pregnancy.
Well, one of the arguments that has been used by the American College of Gynecology and Obstetrics and others. I saw it on a CNN town hall meeting one time with Dr. Sanjay Gupta when a pregnant woman called in. She asked if she should get the vaccine, and he carefully leaned from one side to the other. He kind of crunched one eyebrow, and he said, COVID-19 is a real bad illness in pregnancy, so if you get it, you could be in trouble. You better take the vaccine. Is that a fair risk-benefit analysis, Dr. Stricker?
Well, certainly COVID can cause problems in pregnancy. There have been a number of studies showing an increased risk of miscarriage and complications for the pregnant woman. However, there are also other approaches to preventing that infection that I think have been disregarded because of our focus and our really obsession with these vaccines. For example, hydroxychloroquine has been used in pregnancy for years in women at risk of malaria. It prevents malaria during pregnancy. It's been used like that, and it looks like it could be used the same way to prevent COVID. in women who are pregnant and avoiding the vaccine. So that is another option. There may be other ones coming down the road. A medication called nitazoxanide has been used in pregnancy. That looks very promising for pregnant women. So there are other options other than vaccine.
But isn't it true that programs were reporting through the fall rates of, let's say, 5%? I know ours was 5% of all pregnant women being positive for COVID-19, that the vast majority, I mean, over 99% of them were either asymptomatic or had minimal symptoms. They were just basically acquiring natural immunity. Isn't it true that the risk is far less than 1% for a pregnant woman to have any trouble with COVID-19?
That is true, but that's really the problem with this disease, that it is very unpredictable. And, you know, if you look at the overall statistics, it's mostly, you know, older people and people with, with other medical problems that get sick. But then every now and then you have the 28-year-old doctor who dies of COVID or the 39-year-old mother who dies of COVID. And so that's what makes it very unpredictable and still maintains this fear level that drives the vaccine. So the numbers do look very small, but the complications can be very big.
So it's going to be the hardest thing to weigh out. I think the best advice for women is to talk to their doctor about it. The chances of having any trouble with COVID are far, far less than 1%. The current rates, and they're probably going to go higher, of losing the baby could be 13.9% or even higher over time. And we'll have to see if that's higher than the natural expected rates. And women are going to have to weigh this out. Dr. Stricker points out that we can use hydroxychloroquine safely in pregnancy. We do it in our practice for pregnant women with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus as well. I know I do as an internist. And so it's an effective treatment for COVID-19 in addition to some safe antibiotics. And every so often, we do have to use a steroid medication like prednisone, which is also safe. Aspirin is safe in pregnancy. So we can treat COVID-19 and get women who present with severe symptoms through the illness. So we'll have to see our way forward. But I think every woman ought to look at the risks and benefits themselves for their own situation and consult their doctor. Dr. Stricker, any additional words for our audience before we close this segment?
Well, I think we need a lot more information from the CDC and studies like the very, very preliminary one that was just published. With more time, we probably will get more information. But I think women have to weigh their own risks and talk to their doctors and weigh their risks in pregnancy. And it's very important to do that.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. Dr. Stricker, thank you for joining me on the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. And this is Dr. Peter McCullough. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Layla Lewis. Dr. Lewis received her bachelor's degree from Pacific Union College and then went on to Loma Linda University to get her medical degree. She received a master's in public health from the University of Massachusetts Amherst College, and then she attended her residency in obstetrics and gynecology at Loma Linda University Medical Center. She is now a dedicated obstetrician, inpatient obstetrician in the Banner Health System in the Phoenix metro area. And I've asked her to come on the show to give our listeners some insights on the rapidly moving area of COVID-19 vaccination in pregnant women. Dr. Lewis, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. McCullough. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, this is a real whirlwind time where release of the investigational, either messenger RNA or adenoviral vaccines has come through the FDA and the CDC, and it doesn't require a doctor's order or approval. And it's literally open to almost all categories of people in society outside of children in the United States, although recently there's been an approval to extend it to that group. One of the groups that, among all groups who can accept the vaccine, are pregnant women. And pregnant women were excluded from the randomized trials, the safety trials of COVID-19 vaccine. So even though pregnant women could get a vaccine, there was no studies demonstrating efficacy or safety until a recent report published by the COVID-19 pregnancy registry team in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this appeared April 21st, 2021. So Dr. Gilbert, what I want to understand is before COVID-19, what is the standard in terms of vaccination of pregnant women in terms of other diseases?
So that's a very good question, Dr. McCullough. We give a Tdap vaccine, the idea being to immunize the baby through basically through passive immunization with the mother for tetanus and diphtheria, and mainly pertussis. That's the main goal, because obviously pertussis has a high incidence and mortality in the pediatric population. And then we also do an influenza vaccine, attenuated influenza. And usually, again, we try to use the thimerosal-free versions of that, again, for the pregnant patients.
So pregnant women, as a rule, we just don't inject biologically active vaccines in pregnant women, right?
That's correct. In fact, it is considered a big no-no to give any live vaccines. So, you know, your measles, mumps, and rubella, your varicella vaccine, those kinds of vaccines we definitely avoid in pregnancy for fear that it could directly affect the infant.
And in addition to that, can't fever alone precipitate a miscarriage or a preterm delivery?
Well, what it can definitely, yes, it can, but particularly if you get like a chorioamnionitis or an infection around the baby itself or the placenta around the baby, but or the baby itself gets infected. But also it can cause a neurologic changes, specifically, especially in the early first trimester period of time. And so, yes, we are very wary of heat and temperature in pregnancy.
Well, it's well known from the registrational trials of the messenger RNA vaccines that fever is a well-described symptom after vaccination. I think the idea that because the vaccines were evoking significant vaccination reactions that the FDA and the sponsors excluded pregnant women from the registrational program. And in this New England Journal of Medicine paper, the authors went to the CDC vaccine adverse event reporting system and then reported on women who elected to come forward for vaccination. And they had a large number of women. The two-thirds were in their second and third trimesters. And the results were somewhat surprising and almost shocking in terms of fetal loss. So we ended up with, in this study, of a rate of fetal loss, that is losing the baby through miscarriage or a stillbirth, at 13.9%. And one analysis had put that rate from the National Vital Statistics Repository for 2014 to 2017. At that stage of pregnancy, it should be at 0.59%, because we know there's a lot of fetal loss and miscarriage very early on, but these women were far along. So 13.9% to 0.59%, that would be
That's terrible.
A 24-fold increased rate of losing the baby after the vaccine. Your reaction?
Yeah, that is over the top concerning, I have to say. First of all, any loss, any second, third time, any loss is terrible. But especially when you hit, you know, third trimester, it's just absolutely horrific. And that is very concerning to me. And I find that unfortunate. It's interesting because ACOG just today, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which of course is our governing body, just put out, there was initially the idea that because women are immunosuppressed, that because of pregnancy, that they had a higher mortality associated with COVID, the actual viral syndrome, than the general population. But ACOG just putting out in release to two studies that came out that that's actually not the case. So to accept that kind of risk is quite concerning to me.
In the past, I know hospitals kept track of COVID positivity rates among pregnant women, and rates could run somewhere around 5% just being COVID positive during worst times during the pandemic. The current rates I'd anticipate of being COVID positive or developing COVID through the course of pregnancy would be the same as the registrational trials, and that's less than 1%. So if a woman, whether she received placebo or the vaccine, had a less than 1% chance of developing COVID. However, if they elected to take the vaccine, they would face a 13.9% rate of pregnancy loss. One would weigh that out and say it's simply too risky. And we know now can be easily managed through pregnancy if high-risk features are present with sequenced multi-drug therapy. So Dr. Lewis, are you, when women ask you about this, are you advising them yes or no, or do they just make their own choice on the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, that's a really good question, Dr. McCullough. Of course, the recommendation by my governing body is that pregnant women need to be offered, and not only offered, but encouraged to get the vaccine in one form or the other. I have taken a much more cautious position, and that is there seems to be, first of all, this is an investigational process. This is an emergency authorization. We have not studied this in pregnant women. These are, you know, some of the potential risks. You know, you are putting into your body increase in basically mRNA to produce spike proteins, which we just don't know the end result, especially on the fetus. And so my recommendation is to wait and not take the vaccine.
I think that's fair. You know, you mentioned the word governing body, and it's interesting because we, in this day and age where we're so fearful of what's going on, we almost are taking organizations like medical organizations that try to gather data and give recommendations. We're almost giving them more power or authority than they really have. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, just like the American College of Physicians or the American College of Cardiology, you know, they're medical associations. They really don't govern anything. Nor do they give rulings or verdicts. You know, I'm the president of a major medical society myself, and I can tell you in our charter, we can give recommendations, we can summarize information, but in no way do we tell doctors how to practice medicine. And when a patient comes in the exam room with us, they enter into a fiduciary relationship. That's the relationship between the patient and the doctor. And it's based upon a principle called beneficence. And that means that we're always going to act in the best interest of our patients. And it doesn't matter what recommendations come from any societies, it's based on our clinical judgment. And I was recently, this week on May 7th, I was on Tucker Carlson, Fox Nation, and I told America, as an internist and cardiologist, and I do have pregnant women in my practice who I get consulted on, I told them that my feeling is that, and I have had a firsthand experience of maternal death due to COVID-19, so I know what I'm talking about in terms of risks and benefits. I think looking at the entire picture, my view would be for pregnant women to defer at this point in time until we have more information. You agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. And again, I do not want to give the impression that I'm minimizing the viral syndrome. It is very scary. In certain populations, particularly in the obese, pre-existing asthmatic populations, pre-gestational diabetes, all of these individuals can, when they come in, can just in the as in the regular population, they can be very sick. And just this week, in fact, we had to send a patient to the ICU, and she ended up actually on ECMO. But again, the vast majority, and I mean this in all sincerity, the vast majority of the patients who came in, who all had to have PCR testing before admission to the hospital, if they were a scheduled induction for delivery or for C-section, et cetera, the vast majority who were positive were asymptomatic. And that, of course, corresponds to what we know about the syndrome in general as well. So I believe at this time, with the information that we have in front of us, the safest approach is to the risks, you know, don't outweigh the potential benefit. And I think the wisest thing for our pregnant patients is please wait.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. Dr. Lewis, thank you so much for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thank you so much, Dr. McCullough. It's been a pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report.